From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Should we believe you or the president on the critical issue whether the administration is really willing to make a change in its policy?
That was Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy at Tuesday's confirmation hearing of Robert Gates as Secretary of Defense. With Gates now confirmed and the release of the much-anticipated report of the Iraq Study Group, one question resounds through the media. What will the president decide? Because make no mistake, it's become increasingly clear that he is the decider. Here's Gates in his opening statement.
I will give most serious consideration to the views of those who lead our men and women in uniform. Of course, it is the president who will decide what, if any, changes are made in our approach.
I'm inspired by doing this job. I believe strongly in the decisions I have made.
That was the president with Fox News Channel's Brit Hume on Monday. Time was, the media narrative on President Bush was that he really didn't make his own decisions. You could see the administration's frustration with that storyline, reenacted in a 2003 Showtime documentary, DC 9/11, a White House drama set in the first 9 days after the terrorist attack. There's a scene between Press Secretary Ari Fleischer and Presidential Advisor Karl Rove. Rove is reading an article suggesting that the president's, quote, real keeper was actually Vice President Dick Cheney.
See the op-ed column?
The one about the photograph of POTUS on the Air Force One telephone?
Is he demanding that his real keeper, Cheney, let him go home?
Karl, it's to be expected.
Is it?
Most of them get it. The Cheney runs the show myth is always going to be with some of them. But every day, more and more see what's really going on here.
Oh, I think unquestionably it was a media narrative.
The real former White House press secretary, Ari Fleischer.
It was just kind of a constant buzz to much of the reporting and certainly to many of the questions. And it was 100% wrong. And the perception was President Bush doesn't know what to do. He just can't possibly be in charge, can he? Cheney must be running the show.
I think President Bush, for all of his career, has benefited from what he has called the soft bigotry of low expectations.
Democratic strategist Paul Begala worked in the Clinton White House.
In fact, I remember Governor Bush even commenting on this, I think on the Letterman show. He said that to Letterman after one of the debates. As long as I show up, I look good because everybody thinks I'm so dumb. I think the Democratic narrative, and I participated in it, that Bush was dumb and therefore not really in charge was unhelpful to the Democrats because what it did was it caused Democrats to focus on the monkey, not the organ grinder. Democrats all around the country ran around and said, fire Donald Rumsfeld. Or they ran around the country and said, Dick Cheney was a bad guy. And they ran around and they attacked John Ashcroft or Al Gonzalez. And that's very much in the president's interest.
I read the front page and I know the speculation, but I'm the decider. And I decide what is best. And what's best is for Don Rumsfeld to remain as the Secretary of Defense.
It's very, very difficult for the media that tends to be part of the so-called reality-based community to understand George Bush. It's been difficult for them.
Ron Suskind, author of The Price of Loyalty about the Bush White House and the 1% Doctrine on National Security, first heard the phrase reality-based community from a Bush aide who defined it as people like journalists who, quote, believe that solutions emerge from your judicious study of discernible reality. But the aide told him, quote, that's not the way the world works anymore. We create our own reality.
How is it that we didn't really understand this most important thing of how the president decides what he decides to guide the ship of state? My God, that's right at the top of the list of what the media should be reporting. How could we have not gotten that right?
The assumption was that even if the president lacked wisdom and experience, he had assembled a group of sage advisors who could guide the ship of state.
I think what's happening now is people are realizing that, frankly, many of those people were discounted or discredited as doubters. And hey, they are gone at this point. Their value in terms of guiding the ship of state was probably overstated, maybe wildly overstated. Because at day's end, it was George Bush making decisions for good reason, bad reason, or no discernible reason, but nonetheless deciding.
What was really going on, according to Susskind's sources, was that the decisions of a nation of 300 million were being made by a nation of two.
The best way to put this is that Cheney's created essentially an architecture, a structure, in which Bush can be Bush, his man of action motif, and make decisions accordingly.
When it's all said and done, I will have made decisions based upon principles, and I'm not changing my principles.
Often the senior advisors, let's say beneath Cheney, won't realize why he's making that decision or what's behind it. Then there's talk of this gut, this instinct, this preternatural faith-based surety of the president, this certainty, as he often says. What's its source? And that's where you get into a kind of fog, which is, I think, one of the reasons that the media has had so much trouble teasing this out.
Bush's famously preternatural gut, plus the latest dissenting memos leaked from former National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley and former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, have given rise to a new narrative, Democratic strategist Paul Begala.
The old narrative was that President Bush was dumb and therefore docile. And the new narrative is, well, still not so bright, but much more actually directing things.
Former White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer.
So politically, it becomes convenient for those who used to say that the vice president's in charge now to say George Bush is in charge because it gives them one more criticism to launch at him. Politics aside, he always has been in charge, and the problems that we're going through now in Iraq, and I say this as a supporter of George Bush, are because of the decisions that George Bush made.
Paul Begala says that the old narrative didn't really serve his party, the Democratic Party, in the end. But what about the new narrative?
I think a narrative that focuses entirely on President Bush is more accurate. I'm not sure that it's more helpful in that the re-election is over. The president can't run again. It is probably better for his party, for Mr. Bush, to be the lightning rod. And we're watching now the Republican presidential wannabes pushing off of Mr. Bush.
It does seem that both narratives have worked less well for the Democrats than for the Republicans.
The Democrats, you know what, it's a very actually important point about how Democrats deal with media versus Republicans. My party, Democrats, tend to be the party of the laundry list. We have four-point plans for everything. We have more solutions than the country has problems. Republicans, understanding the media better, because they mostly are still disciples of Ronald Reagan, the master of media, they mostly tell narratives. They tell stories. And stories beat laundry lists every time.
So that's the story for now. As the president said to Brit Hume Monday,
you know, I'm the commander in chief. I make decisions based upon what I think is best to achieve our objectives.
And like it or not, that presidential statement is solidly, decisively reality based.
From Dick Van Dyke's dancing partners in Mary Poppins to Tennessee Tuxedo to Batman's waddling nemesis, the penguin has long been anthropomorphized by the media. But lately, penguins have found extra work as political symbols. As recently as last summer, for instance, penguins were embraced by the Christian right because of their impeccable family values. They can't fly and they stink of fish, but they also don't divorce or have abortions. Commenting on the documentary March of the Penguins, WorldNetDaily.com, a conservative website, wrote that it, quote, verified the beauty of life and the rightness of protecting it. Nationally syndicated conservative radio talk show host Michael Medved said the movie passionately affirms traditional norms like monogamy, sacrifice, and child rearing. But then came the Penguin's Mary Cheney moment. A new children's book called And Tango Makes Three recounts the true story of a pair of male penguins in Central Park Zoo who adopted a fertilized egg and raised the chick as their own. Yes, Chilly Willy has two daddies. The book was recently pulled off some library shelves in Illinois due to the implied celebration of bird-on-bird sinfulness. And then there's the new animated penguin movie hit, Happy Feet.
All our sakes, you must stop this freaking us with the feet.
Don't ask me to change, Pa, because I can't.
All you gotta do is sing.
This one, with plot lines concerning overfishing and ocean pollution, puts the penguin smack in the middle of the environmental debate. Sort of Aaron Brockovich in a cummerbund. Here's director George Miller.
But you can't tell the story of the penguins and of Antarctica without telling the story of its environmental threat. I mean, it's like the canary in the mine.
So now comes political backlash from the right, miffed that its mascot, like the Reverend Ted Haggard, has strayed in the direction of the evil other. Here's CNN's Glenn Beck complaining about the hidden political message in Happy Feet.
Tell me about it first, okay? So I know I'm walking in to propaganda. But with Happy Feet, no, they just couldn't. They couldn't shoehorn that into the marketing. That'd be too tough. I wonder if it's because they knew that people, wouldn't go see it, or not as many. They may not pull in $42 million if people thought they'd be watching an animated version of An Inconvenient Truth.
Can't media right-wingers just turn the other beak? No, they cannot. Here's Fox News Channel's Neil Cavuto.
I thought it was like an animated Inconvenient Truth. I half expected to see an animated version of Al Gore pop up.
Interesting metaphor, considering another recent penguin development. Al Gore's Penguin Army, a YouTube video spoof of the anti-global warming documentary An Inconvenient Truth. The video was supposed to have been made by a 29-year-old amateur in Beverly Hills, but the Wall Street Journal traced it to a computer registered to a Republican PR and lobbying firm in Washington, D.C. ExxonMobil is one of their largest clients. Next year, two more penguin movies are slotted for release, a spoof of March of the Penguins called Farce of the Penguins, and a Sony feature, Surf's Up. Huh. Strange. And just before the presidential election.
Coming up, a live-action debate on global warming and the media.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In his 4 years at the helm of the Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works, Republican James Inhofe has held four hearings on global warming. The fourth was on Wednesday and focused not on the science or policy implications of climate change, but on the media coverage of it. Suffice it to say, Inhofe is not a fan.
Much of the mainstream media has subverted its role as an objective source of information on climate change into a role of an advocate. We've seen examples of this overwhelmingly one-sided reporting by 60 Minutes reporter Scott Pelley, ABC's Bill Blakemore, CNN's Miles O'Brien, which I believe is here with us today or will be, Time Magazine, Associated Press, Reuters, just to name a few.
Inhofe called on two scientists and a media watchdog who testified that catastrophic predictions are entirely overblown and that humans' role in global warming is still up for debate. Two witnesses invited by Democrats argued that scientific consensus suggested the opposite. One reporter, whose name was frequently invoked by both sides, was Andrew Revkin, science correspondent for The New York Times. Here's Senator Inhofe in his opening statement.
We know from an April 23, 2006 article in The New York Times by Andrew Revkin that, quote, few scientists agree with the idea that the recent spate of potential hurricanes, European heat waves, African droughts, and other weather extremes are, in essence, our fault, a result of man-made emissions.
The author of those words wasn't at the hearing, and if he were, he might have finished the quote himself, because the original article went on to say that
between the poles of real-time catastrophe and non-event lies the prevailing scientific view. Without big changes in emissions rates, global warming from the buildup of greenhouse gases is likely to lead to substantial and largely irreversible transformations of climate, ecosystems, and coastlines later this century.
Andy Revkin, thanks for correcting the record.
Completing the record, I guess.
In a few weeks, of course, Senator Inhofe will be stepping down as chairman of this committee. Now, this is the man who famously called the threat of catastrophic global warming, quote, the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people. But have the media always been such a target of his criticism?
This year, he really kind of took on the media. And the reason is early this year, there was a spate of coverage that really took this issue into a sort of high gear. Time magazine had its Be Worried, Be Very Worried cover about global warming, and Inhofe saw an opportunity here. The problem with global warming has been and remains, and was the case at this hearing, that there's always enough information out there for anybody to build a case on.
Is the fundamental problem here, then, that Inhofe really believes that there isn't a scientific consensus or even discounts the idea of a scientific consensus on this issue? That climate science, like any other issue, has two sides and needs to be reported that way?
Yeah, I think that is very much what he and many other people believe. Many people in America, I think, not just hardened partisans, have trouble understanding that science is a trajectory toward understanding. And what you have along the way is a lot of punctuation marks, which are particular papers, some particular scientists' work. And those papers will take a position that could be a little bit off from the actual trajectory of knowledge. And so you end up always having just enough science in the room to suit everybody. But when you get back to the bedrock on this issue, there isn't any scientist working in this field who would disagree that more carbon dioxide will make the world a warmer place.
Even Inhofe believes that.
Yeah, he acknowledges the world is warming. He just feels, based on his review of the evidence, that there's no evidence of a human component.
He seems to discount the whole discussion as a kind of journalistic fad following in the footsteps of past fads over the last century. Some warning of impending warming, others warning of a looming ice age just around the corner. Now, what do you make of that critique?
Well, the media, we love to grab onto the front page thought and whatever the news is. And back in the early 70s, the world was actually cooling a bit, and science detected that. You know, we've been in a warm period between ice ages for a long time, and some scientists at that point were positing that we were heading back into the next one. And that's a pretty sexy kind of front page thought right there. And there were cover stories in magazines and in newspapers saying that implications were heading into the cold. But that didn't last. There's a long sense now of how that little temporary cooling fits into the pattern of general warming. In fact, it probably was a result of other kinds of pollution that after World War II got up in the atmosphere and blocked sunlight, making the world a little cooler for the 40s through the 70s. And now that's all gone. The Clean Air Act actually worked here in this country at any rate. And so you have the warming trend resumed. And if we were still talking about a coming ice age, then you could say the media were locked into it. But it was a very temporary blip in the coverage.
The CJR blog, Columbia Journalism Review blog, talked about how journalists who report on this issue nowadays don't feel as constrained as they used to about reporting on both sides of the issue because the scientific consensus is so strong on one side. In your view, is there anything wrong with reporting on climate change one-sidedly?
We've been getting this story wrong in three different ways over time. we got it wrong for too long by saying, on the one hand, on the other hand, even as the scientific consensus powerfully built around the basic idea, more CO2, warmer world. The other way we got it wrong is when you have a story that's breaking news, but on a century timescale, that doesn't fit our journalistic norms for what's news. There's no news peg, you know, the hook. So wait a minute, didn't we already write about global warming back in 1988?
Right.
Didn't we do that story? The third mistake, I think, is now that we got over the hurdle of understanding that there really is a consensus on the main idea. Many of my colleagues seem to feel that means that there's a consensus on every aspect of the global warming problem.
Right.
Unfortunately, the things that matter most to people, like how is this going to affect Chicago? Or what's going to happen with Greenland's ice? How fast are sea levels going to rise? There's a lot of uncertainty in those aspects of it. And there you really do have legitimate kind of, on the one hand, on the other hand, arguments. And the biggest one of all recently was hurricanes. There were two new peer-reviewed studies earlier this year that said they found that hurricanes were already getting stronger because of human-warmed oceans. A lot of my colleagues seem to think that meant there's a consensus now on hurricanes, but there is no such thing.
A lot of media critics see a sort of clash of civilization between science and journalism, and that journalism seems to call for a narrative. There's usually a beginning and an end. And since science is all process, the end of the story rarely stays the same. And that lies at the heart of the problem of reporting on science. Is that how you see it?
It's certainly a big part of it. And by the way, scientists, you know, they're eager to get funding for their next study. So they often end their papers with a kind of an exclamation point. And the whole process is set up to amplify that this is the new knowledge. This new study has advanced things. And of course, we've had so many false steps through that. I guess what it takes in the journalists who are covering this is just an extra bit of skepticism, but not to then use the skepticism as a way to shape the story cynically, but just to make sure that you frame what we know today as a step on a journey that could have twists and turns. So there is progress. There are things we understand. There are things we understand powerfully about a human influence on the global thermostat. Absolutely. But when someone says something that's particularly powerful, particularly conclusive, that's all the more reason to just ask one or two more questions.
Andy, thank you very much.
It's always a pleasure.
Andrew Revkin covers climate change for the New York Times, and he's the author of the book, The North Pole Was Here.
On Monday, the Supreme Court issued taped proceedings in a school integration case. Hearing same-day audio from the High Court is a recent development. It was only 6 years ago, when the court was hearing arguments about the contested election in Gore v. Bush, that we were able to listen in on the proceedings almost in real time. And that's because then-Chief Justice William Rehnquist decided, in the midst of the controversy, that more transparency was called for, and so it continues to this day. Up to a point. The court allows the public to listen in only to cases it deems important. But Dahlia Lithwick, legal correspondent for Slate, wants the chance to hear all of the proceedings on the same day. And she's not alone in this. In fact, Republican Senator Arlen Specter wants the opportunity to see them, too.
Arlen Specter every year tries to pass legislation that would allow cameras into the courtroom. He's the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and he's also one of the people who sort of got the most kind of eagle eye on constitutional matters. And he thinks it's simply, you know, unthinkable that the court isn't covered the way the other branches of government are covered. And every year there's this sort of slap fight back and forth between the Supreme Court and senators like Specter. Some of the Supreme Court justices who are now sitting have testified before Congress, and famously, Justice David Souter said, if you roll those cameras in, you'll roll them in over my cold, dead body. So they feel very, very strongly, the justices, that this is simply not going to happen.
Now, one of the peculiarities of the change in court policy is the selection of cases that it has chosen to let the public listen in on. In your Slate piece, you describe them as a series of hot-button cases that may or may not have a whole lot of legal significance, but certainly are ones that are polarizing in the public.
Just a quick look suggests that they keep doing it in the abortion cases, in the affirmative action cases, in the don't ask, don't tell, gays in the military case, and in the enemy combatant cases. What that means to me is that they're picking unfailingly these very, very tense, tend to be 5-4, as you said, polarizing cases. It's so interesting to me that Chief Justice John Roberts and Sandra Day O'Connor and Stephen Breyer are all out there saying over and over again, if you only understood what judges do, you wouldn't accuse us of being activist. What we do is actually very nuanced, very technical, very difficult. And then they go out and they audio the most tense cases. They're doing it exactly wrong. Release audio for some really dull Commerce Clause cases or some incredibly boring marine law cases. Choose the cases that are more representative of what it is that the court does every day.
Until 2000, everything I knew about oral arguments at the Supreme Court were based on Nina Totenberg reading her own transcripts of them. It always amazed me that decisions were based on the basis of them. They seemed so superficial and sometimes going down blind alleys. If you listen to the oral arguments on tape or any other way, what do you learn about the Supreme Court and its deliberations?
I've heard several justices say a great oral argument will not often turn justices around. But if you get up there and really sort of bollocks things up, you can lose some of the justices. And that's, I think, the conventional wisdom. But with that said, I think that what happens at oral argument and what people are really missing out on, and it's one of the things that Nina Totenberg does so well, you're missing out on the sort of human drama, you know, the complexity of what it is to be this big dysfunctional family of nine who sit together every day. For instance, Justice Clarence Thomas doesn't speak. He asks maybe 6 or 7 questions all year long, whereas, you know, Justice Scalia asks 6 or 7 questions in 10 minutes. And I do think that the more people saw oral argument or at least heard what happened there, the more they'd feel the sort of affection for the court that court watchers feel.
I got to ask you, you know, we are pretty much reflexively for more transparency, not less, but in the case of cameras in the courtroom, as we have seen by watching lots of court TV, there seems to be a palpable effect on the proceedings by the very presence of the camera. Isn't there a very real chance that it compromises the process?
That's certainly a very legitimate argument. It's one that several of the justices have made. They have good arguments and bad arguments for keeping cameras out. The bad arguments are we don't want to be recognized at the Safeway. That's not a good argument. The good arguments are once there's a camera trained on these attorneys, they're going to start barking like seals and acting goofy. But from courts around the country, the feedback has been, you know, it really isn't that damaging. Everybody gets used to it and they go on with their business.
Over David Souter's dead body and all that, does anyone but the court have the authority to mandate permitting cameras in the Supreme Court chambers?
It could develop into quite a legal question about whether anyone can force the court to do that against their will. I don't know that it's going to come to that. My strong sense is that the justices who feel extremely strongly that they don't want cameras in there, notably David Souter, notably Antonin Scalia, are eventually simply not going to be on the court. And I think that John Roberts, and you see it already, he did a major television broadcast 2 weeks ago. He's much more media savvy. He's much less fearful of the television cameras. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't know that there's really support for major legislation that would force cameras into the courtroom over the wishes of all the justices.
Dahlia, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
Dahlia Lithwick is a legal reporter and senior editor at Slate.com. Before the era of same-day audio of the Supreme Court, if you wanted details of the day's proceedings, there was the written word, and there was Nina Totenberg. Working from her carefully written notes, NPR's legal correspondent set a new standard for legal radio drama. Here, she reenacts a case about wearing buttons with messages in a murder trial.
Justice Souter, what if the button had said, "Hang Musladin"? Answer, that would be so egregious that it would affect the fairness of the trial. Justice Souter, why? Answer, because the message is urging the jury to convict him. Justice Souter, what's wrong with that? The prosecutor is going to get up and urge the jury to convict him anyway. Chief Justice Roberts, how different is it from the victim's family sitting behind the prosecution every day of the trial?
While she conjures up the moods of the Supremes, she stops short of actually mimicking them.
It would smack of real disrespect. I mean, if I were going to imitate Justice O'Connor, for example, totally, I would have to get sort of a Southwestern twang into my voice and my nose. And if I was going to imitate Justice Ginsburg, I would be assuming a kind of a quiet, some might call it mouse-like voice. you don't want to mimic their accents, but what you do want to do is get the texture of their question as reflected in their voice, which is why I sometimes refer to Justice Scalia, for example, as I'll say Justice Scalia puckishly, because that reflects just the way he looks. He sort of leans forward and he's got this little look on his face like, I'm going to really get you here. Or I will refer to Justice Kennedy as red-faced because when he gets ticked, he gets red.
I must say that when I first heard Sandra Day O'Connor's voice, it was something like that scene in Singing in the Rain when the audience first hears Lena Lamont's voice, her squeaking voice that did not quite comport with her screen image. It was a little of a shocker for me.
Well, she's Dale Evans, the Supreme Court Justice, is the truth. This is a justice who was brought up on a ranch, and that's what she sounds like.
So tell me, now comes the opportunity to actually have recorded voices of the oral arguments from the justices, and, you know, maybe the possibility of having it as a routine procedure. How do you feel about that?
Well, in candor, I don't know a broadcast journalist who thinks that would be a wonderful idea on a daily basis because it is so much more work. It is very difficult to actually and accurately represent the way the argument went by using the tape, because the tape is so much legal jargon and there's so much case names and you can't sandwich it in. It might be, for example, something involving sentencing. Very important, but absolutely arcane. Very hard even when I'm listening to it to figure it out. Now, this term, for the first time, we have pretty much contemporaneous transcripts, which we never had before. Everything until this year that you heard on the air when I do my recapitulations was based on my notes. And in some ways, the transcripts have been far more revelatory to me than the audio is. I want to add, Bob, here, I'm not making an argument against having the tape. I'm just saying that if anybody thinks that having the tape will make it more easily understandable, they are wrong.
Well, Nina, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Nina Totenberg is the legal affairs correspondent for National Public Radio.
Coming up, move over, BBC, CNN, and Al Jazeera. Here comes France 24.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, featuring a new book by Carl Schramm, The Entrepreneurial Imperative, at kauffman.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, exploring how technology is changing kids and learning, at digitallearning.macfound.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, the 24-hour news channel game got a little bigger with the launch of France 24.
Bonjour à tous. This is France 24.
The new government-funded satellite cable and internet channel launched this week in Europe, Africa, the Middle East, New York, and Washington. Today it's available in French and English, and plans are to add Arabic and Spanish down the line. It is a new station, but an old idea. A recent story in Business Week speculated that the French desire to speak to the world dates back two decades, but that French President Jacques Chirac got particularly keen on it in 2002 when France felt stifled in the pre-war debate. After all, America had CNN, the Brits had the BBC, but let's face it, in America at least, misunderstanding the French has a rich history that certainly predates the war in Iraq.
Bonjour! You cheese-eating surrender monkeys!
That's groundskeeper Willie on The Simpsons in 1995. In the late 90s, National Review columnist Jonah Goldberg re-injected the phrase into the mainstream media. By the time France was blocking the war at the United Nations Security Council, the phrase had resurfaced and surrender monkeys was being gleefully repeated on Fox News and other, apparently, francophobic news outlets. But that's just us Yanks. Jacques Chirac, in spearheading the effort to launch the new channel, probably intended to convey his nation's true nature to the world. That would be consistent, says Jack Doppelt, a journalism professor from Medill University, visiting at the Institut d'Etudes Politiques de Paris.
You know, France has a very serious inferiority complex now and for the past generation. And that is a part of French conversation here. You know, why isn't France as important as it used to be in anything, whether it's films or perfume making or wine making or politics? This did come out of the brain of Jacques Chirac after the breakdown between France's position on the Iraq War and the United States and Britain. And in his head, that's what made it seem so important that France's image, its being, get out there to the world.
So is the Paris street buzzing about France 24 right now?
No, it's not, of course. It's ironic. The whole idea of France 24 is to export some notion of France and French culture. Nobody knows even what channel here you can get it on.
Its mission statement, more or less, suggests that what it really wants to do is spread French art de vivre, I guess the art of life, around the world. Well, what exactly is that?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, there are three things that it's now projecting as what it wants to get out there. Some notion of diversity, some notion of debate, because French talk shows use the format of lively debate, and the art of living. And the art of living is just a notion of lifestyle. In simple form, it might be the shorter work week that France has. Well, if you think about how is that going to be projected in the day-to-day news stories, and the answer is it's not really. So I know exactly what France 24's promotional material has been saying, but I don't know how it's actually going to serve the end that it claims to be serving, which is not to say that it won't be a valuable product for the world to have. More reporters out in the world shooting more stories with more images and more material from parts of the world that are underreported. That's a good thing. But I would be totally shocked if it succeeded in getting a France's art of living or anything else that's purely French.
France 24 wants to do original worldwide reporting on an 80 million euro budget that amounts to about $114 million compared to CNN's $856 million. They're going to be beating back much better established and better funded competitors.
Yes, and I think they know that. It is not going to make the kind of statement that an Al Jazeera is making, as it turns out, in pretty much the same time in the same places in the world. I tend to think if they're thinking modestly, it may be a useful product for the world to have. If they're thinking commercial success, which they're not, but if they're thinking at least financial viability, that's even going to be hard.
So it's something more akin to, say, Germany's Deutsche Welle than it would be to the British BBC, if they're lucky.
Exactly. And Russia even has a channel, Russia Today. So I think despite its pretenses of trying to be one of the major players, it even had to change its promotional materials to saying it was going to be the third among three to now being the fourth among four with Al Jazeera. And, you know, it's not even taking into account Euronews and Sky and Deutsche Welle and all types of other stations, and the only thing they have in common is they tend to present as being news-oriented programming for 24 hours a day. Other than that, they're competing against dozens and dozens and dozens of news and reality and documentary channels. So I predict that it will be a modest player in the scheme of things.
I think what you've suggested is that maybe the French perspective isn't distinct enough to have made a difference, even if they had the cash to back it.
I agree with that. I don't think it is distinct enough. It is adjusting a little bit its promotional materials to really be, for instance, it started up by saying something like, everything you're not supposed to know, and no one had any idea what France had to offer about things you're not supposed to know, since the basic news orientation in France is kind of cozy with its politicians, and you're not going to know things you're not supposed to know. So they changed it a bit to be the French eye on world news, beyond the news, all of these kind of cliches. And what it's really trying to stake out is that it is going to be in places in the world that are underreported. However, for that, it seems to me that if you're in the United States and you want a new flavor, you want to see stories from places like the Congo and Togo and Sierra Leone, you're not going to be turning to them. You're going to be turning to Al Jazeera.
All right. Jack, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Jack Doppelt is a visiting professor at the Institut d'études politiques de Paris. Back home, he's a professor at Northwestern University's McGill School of Journalism.
For 2 weeks, the world has been transfixed by the murder of former Russian spy Alexander Litvinenko, the vocal critic of Vladimir Putin, who was poisoned in London with a lethal dose of the radioactive isotope polonium-210.
A few days ago, he told BBC Radio what happened.
Someone came up to me and said that we should meet. The meeting took place in a restaurant in London. He gave me some papers which contained some names on it, perhaps names of those who may have been involved in the murder of Anna Politkovskaya. And several hours after the meeting, I started to feel sick.
In the last few minutes, we have had a statement from the hospital. I'm afraid it's not a terribly encouraging statement. They said that his condition has deteriorated.
Alexander Litvinenko died at University College Hospital at 9:21 on the 23rd of
Hill today. Until now, the police have concentrated their efforts on London, searching addresses and interviewing potential witnesses. Today, the Home Secretary said the investigation was set to broaden.
Friday, we learned that a chief witness in the case has himself been poisoned. The episode has cast suspicion on the Kremlin and created political tension between Russia and the West. It has also generated a wave of what can only be called Cold War nostalgia, hearkening back to the good old days when those licensed to kill murdered each other and left the rest of us alone. But this stranger-than-fiction tale also reminds us of something else we used to really love, spy fiction. Despite the retro thrills of the current Bond hit Casino Royale, the genre isn't what it was back when we were waging the Cold War. But as Jim Zaroli first reported for us back in 2004, it continues to have big fans in the most classified places.
For most of his life, Danny Biederman has been collecting props and mementos from TV shows and movies about spies. Things like the leather pants that Diana Rigg wore in The Avengers, or a Walter PPK handgun from You Only Live Twice. A few years ago, Biederman got a phone call from none other than the CIA, which wanted him to display his entire collection at the agency's headquarters in Langley, Virginia. At first, Biederman couldn't believe that serious real-life intelligence professionals would be interested in the shoe phone used on Get Smart.
It was fascinating to me to discover that, in fact, many of the people working for the CIA, and I'm sure other intelligence organizations in the United States, love spy movies. They love spy thrillers, and in fact, many of the people who I met actually disclosed to me that the reason they joined the CIA was because they grew up like I did on James Bond and The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and I Spy and The Wild Wild West.
Biederman, who's written a book called The Incredible World of Spy-Fi, grew up in the 1960s, the heyday of spy stories. They had been part of popular culture for a long time before that, stretching all the way back to the days of James Fenimore Cooper. But in 1962, a new kind of spy was born, a spy for the Cold War. Based on Ian Fleming's novel, Dr. No introduced the movie audience to James Bond, the suave government agent who lived like a playboy and had a license to kill. He took on the communists with ingenuity, double entendres, and a seemingly inexhaustible supply of high-tech gadgets.
You were admiring my aquarium.
Yes. It's quite impressive.
A unique feat of engineering, if I may say so. I designed it myself. The glass is convex, 10 inches thick, which accounts for the magnifying effect.
Minnows pretending they're whales, just like you on this island, Dr. No.
It depends, Mr. Bond, on which side of the glass you are. A medium dry martini, lemon peel, shaken, not stirred.
Gary Hoppenstand is a professor of American studies at Michigan State University.
What it did is it sort of made use of the Cold War kind of culture and paranoia that was in place in the late 50s and early 60s in terms of basically creating a superhero. And I use that term exactly. I mean, James Bond is a kind of comic book superhero cast as a spy.
Hoppenstein says that unlike previous spy characters, Bond appealed to both male and female audiences and was wildly popular with both. Over the next few years, the series inspired an endless parade of imitators in TV and the movies, shows like Mission Impossible and Secret Agent. There were even female Bonds like Emma Peel of The Avengers and Honey West, who hid smoke grenades in her earrings. There was often something tongue-in-cheek about these shows. On The Man from U.N.C.L.E., Robert Vaughn played an agent for the United Network Command for Law and Enforcement, doing battle against a shadowy international group called Thrush. His boss was played by Leo G. Carroll.
We'll have to find her before Thrush stumbles onto her.
We'll find her.
Yes, please. Do that, Mr. Zolo.
Within a few years, the genre tipped into parody with Get Smart and the Matt Helm movies and burned itself out. In the 70s, revelations about CIA abuses changed the image of the spy in the popular imagination, and spy stories became much different in tone. Fred Hitz is a former CIA official who recently wrote a book about spy fiction called The Great Game. He says spy novels from that era often betrayed a moral ambivalence about spying. It's exemplified, he says, by the works of John le Carré.
By the time the Cold War comes around, le Carré has developed the view that the bureaucracy itself, the mechanism, control, MI6 headquarters, is just as guilty of playing dirty tricks on its own people as it is in pursuit of the holy grail of espionage information from the Soviets. And his turn of the screw was to say, hey, in terms of human qualities and behavior and loyalty, there's not a dime's worth of difference between the way the Soviets go about it and the way we do it if we adopt their tactics.
In John le Carré's Smiley's People, the protagonist, George Smiley, realizes that a former Soviet informant was allowed to die by the British government.
Vladimir was the best source we had on Soviet capabilities and intentions. He was close to their intelligence community and reported on that, too.
Oh, damn it, George, that whole era is dead.
And so is Vladimir. And I wish to God we got half his courage and one-tenth of his integrity.
George, we are pragmatists. We adapt. We are not the keepers of some sacred flame.
Le Carré's ambivalence about the spy world was echoed in American spy fiction. In stories like 3 Days of the Condor and the Robert Ludlum books, the real threat facing the hero is no longer the communists, but murderous forces within the CIA itself. More recently, Tom Clancy has reinvented the spy story once again. Michigan State's Gary Hoppenstein says Clancy's protagonist, Jack Ryan, is a heroic figure, and though he does battle with interfering politicians, he never doubts the morality of the CIA's mission. Hoppenstein says Clancy's personality is the antithesis of James Bond's.
That is, he's a family man. He's not this 007 agent with a license to kill, that he's not trying to bed every beautiful woman around. He's very serious and dedicated in terms of what he wants to do for the U.S. government. I mean, the CIA loved him. The CIA now were the good guys rather than the bad guys.
But Fred Hitt says for all of the changes that have taken place in the spy genre, movies and books have left many people with an unrealistic sense of how spies work and what they can accomplish.
It's the James Bond image, the Q device that people think of that permits you to pierce a wall with a sensory system or look over buildings to surveil a target that we assume our spies can do. We also assume that our human source collectors, our on-the-ground spies, are able to gain entry to any circle if we work hard at it, and that remains to be seen.
In the current war on terror, U.S. intelligence operatives have had trouble penetrating a world that is culturally and politically very different from their own. Hitt says people who've seen a lot of spy movies probably wouldn't recognize real intelligence activity.
Drudgery, painstaking, detailed work, much of which is tangential to the real decisions being made, but has to be pursued in the hope that there's a nugget there that'll guide the policymaker.
And by focusing on the derring do and glamour of espionage work, it says, people may be overlooking the really interesting spy stories out there. They include the breaking of the Enigma Code during World War II, when a large team of mathematicians and intelligence agents were gradually able to crack a Nazi code machine that was once thought to be impenetrable. And they include the Robert Hansen story. Could Hollywood ever have imagined that a mild-mannered, conservative CIA agent who sent his kids to Catholic schools was secretly cavorting with a stripper and spying for the Soviets? In the espionage world, it says, truth is very much stranger than fiction. For On the Media, I'm Jim Zaroli.
This is Commander Gilmore, U.S. Strategic Command, and General Bolshevsky, Russian intelligence.
Russian intelligence? Are you mad?
A lot's happened since you were frozen. The Cold War's over.
Well, finally those capitalist pigs will pay for their crimes, eh? Hey, comrades? Hey?
Austin, we won.
Oh, groovy, smashing. Yay, capitalism.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Vallo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Alicia Rebensdorf and Michael McLaughlin. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org and subscribe to our newsletter at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at wnyc.org. And thanks.